Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 141, being recorded on the 22nd of August, 2016, with special guest, Katrine DeGrave. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, and a co-host, Russell Young. Hey, guys. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I don't know what your listeners have done to upset you and having me back on again, but yeah, pleased to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Some of our listeners might remember Russell. He was actually on the show a couple of times already, both as a guest and a co-host, so glad to have him back. And our special guest, Katrine, is also on the line, but we're going to get started with some recent updates in the Azure space before we allow her to introduce herself and talk about a topic that we've not discussed before in on this podcast. And we'll allow her to elaborate on that and why that's something that's very important for our Azure users. So we'll get to that in a minute. So anyway, let's start with the recent updates. And as usual, Kale has done a good job outlining some of them. Kale, is there any one you want to start with?
Yeah, probably the first one to start off with is this news about PowerShell being open sourced and running on Linux, which is pretty big news if you're anybody who's in the DevOps space or have been using Azure. We have, as you probably know, or our listeners probably know, we have multiple different tools to allow people to kind of work with this from a command line type interface as opposed to some GUI like our portal. And usually we do have two kind of worlds there. We have PowerShell, which is centered around Windows type admins or people who are running on Windows, and then the CLI, which is cross-platform, which works on Windows and Linux and Mac and all the nice things out there. This is pretty big, though, because the problem is there's always a little bit of kind of feature gap between these. They generally, become the same over time. So they're basically, PowerShell might come out with something, and then you'll see it in CLI a little bit later. There's typically a little bit of lag time there. And so this is going to help, you know, drop that down a bit so that we can leverage the bigger community who's building PowerShell scripts on, Linux-type workloads and admins.
Yeah, I think this is definitely the biggest news of the week. Now, just from a broader perspective, though, from an administrator perspective, what does it open up as an administrator? Does that mean that you could use the same language to administer not only your Windows machines but also your Linux and Mac OS X machines? Is that kind of what we're going out there?
Yeah, I think the issue you typically run into is we build really cool and sometimes you get very complex PowerShell scripts for it's usually around deployment or something of that nature in Azure. And then we get approached with a customer or partner who says, that's cool, but I'm running my workloads all on Linux, and we don't even have a Windows machine here. So then, you're kind of in a situation where it's like, well, we can spin up a VM that's just running Windows just so you can do this one piece of admin work. But then it's not really going to fit nice with their overall management and DevOps solution. So I think this will kind of help fill that gap a bit. And I think this is kind of coming out of some of the .NET Core being able to run on Linux, you're starting to see more of that crossover there. I think that's kind of where that's coming from.
Yeah, I think one of the things as well is desired state configuration. So I'm assuming that once this is out there, that DSC will work okay on, fully supported on Linux as well, whereas at the moment I think it only has a small subset of what it can do. So DSC being desired state configuration, allowing you to automatically update your environment via a configuration file. So I think that's a pretty powerful side effect of this announcement as well.
Yeah. Good point. Very good point. DSC is part of it. And yeah, I think, Gail, you're right. The fact that a lot of PowerShell modules are written in .NET, right? And now you get that same .NET can be run on using .NET Core can be run on multiple platforms. So it's probably all tied in. That's good. Russell, is there anything you have a list of the recent updates? Is there anyone that you'd like to dig into?
Yeah, so there was this one about the Azure SQL DB threat detection. So there's an announcement up there. I mean, it's been there for a little while now, but I quite like the blog post. It went into some details about scenarios. So this is services that run in the background on Azure that are constantly monitoring what's going on and looking out for patterns that are abnormal in terms of the usage. So they're looking out for logins from IP address ranges that you may not have used before, or times when you might not have used it, or unexpected loads and stuff like that. So I quite enjoyed reading about some of the scenarios. There was one about an ex-employee coming back to access their production database some months after they've been dismissed or left the company, and that got picked up on. And the other one that I didn't know it did was this warning about SQL injection attack vulnerabilities. So I guess it's looking at the query plans that are going on and looking out for dynamically generated SQL, and then telling the operators that there's some code that's running here that hasn't been using bind variables or stored procs in the correct kind of way. So that was highlighting that vulnerability, allowing them to go off and change their code and fix it. Because SQL injection attacks being one of the biggest culprits in the OWASP top 10 list of vulnerabilities still.
Yeah,
so that was quite interesting.
That is a very interesting one, yeah. And the one that I liked was, we haven't talked about Azure Search much. I think we had somebody on the show a while ago, but I'm glad that they're still doing a lot of things with it, and they've opened up our blobs and tables to be used as sources of data that can be indexed. So, for example, if you've got blob storage that has maybe Word documents or Outlook messages and things like that, now you can, using the portal, there's a GUI that allows you to point to those blob items as a data source, and it will automatically consume that and be able to search the contents inside of it. So that's a new feature that's available in the portal now.
Yeah, that relies on, well, it doesn't just rely on, but you can add metadata with blobs as well. So when you store a blob up there, it has a load of metadata associated with it, and you can create custom metadata items, and the indexer goes through that as well. So you can add your own kind of custom index fields in there. So that is a really nice one.
Yep.
I think the other big one this week, Sajid, is something that's been out for a long time, is the service bus integration into the new portal. So I think this just got announced a bit. There's a blog post here, I think last Friday, about it, about the ability now to create and manage, some of the service bus resources like namespaces, queues, and topics, and these things in the new portal. That's been a long time thing. That's, service bus is a really foundation service. It's been there for a long time, and it's finally now in the new portal. So we can do it through the GUI as well as obviously through the API and scripting interfaces.
I always hated that you had to flip and flop between the two GUIs, for various things. So I'm glad they're finally moving everything over to the new GUI. That's all good.
So I guess that means the service bus then fits into resource groups that you want to supply. So that'll be nice. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this stuff's in preview, I think, right now, actually. And the word is that the public word is that all these services, including some stuff that's coming in October, like the relay service, will be available in the new portal. We'll all be in preview until at least late October. So if you're using those, it's one of those new things that's still in preview.
And then there was an update on the Azure Government. I think our listeners might remember that we had Aaron Barth on a few episodes ago talking about Azure Government. And I think this is primarily, unfortunately, a U.S. Feature. But that the government service is kind of always behind the main Azure services, because they have to get these additional certifications before they can get released. And so they've now had a bunch of new certifications, FedRAMP, HAI, DSAR, L4, ITAR support, etc., and including some support for specific states. Like there are some states in the U.S. that have specific requirements for cloud services, and these are now all, these have been updated. So if you're in the Azure Government space, please take a look at that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Russell, is there anything else that you had a couple more items in your list?
Yeah, so there's the HTTP 2 support for Azure CDN, the ones that are coming in are supported by Akamai, and they're working on the Verizon version over the next few months, I believe. But for anybody that's into the networking, the HTTP 2 protocol, I don't know if, Kel, you know much about HTTP 2. I'm not a networking expert. I understand it gives some performance benefits and things like that, but I don't know much about the detail of that specification.
That's good to know. Thanks. Well, I think we've covered quite a few of the new updates, so let's not keep our guest today waiting much longer. Katrina, please let our listeners know what, you know, give us some introduction about yourself and what you do at Microsoft, and then we can carry on the discussion from there.
Yes, great. Thanks for inviting me. So I'm a TSP, so that means like technical sales role within a number of countries in Microsoft. So I work in a team that physically I'm based in Belgium, but I cover 12 countries of Europe, and so travel a bit around and work primarily in technical sales scenarios, we call them, but it's primarily working together with customers, a customer-facing role, doing POCs, doing all kinds of customer support, and supporting other colleagues when it comes around a number of services that are around applications on Azure. So I do a lot with app service, API management. We're starting to do a lot of Logic Apps, which has been now a G8 last month, and related services, basically.
Okay, and I know we had, last week, actually, we spoke to Kevin Lamb on Logic Apps. You know, it's part of the application service suite that we have there. So, but generally speaking, how are you seeing, what's the adoption for all these app services today in Europe, especially? Like, how do you see people actually using them? Do they understand how they can be leveraged, or is this something that you have to do to work with customers and help them take advantage of these services?
Well, yeah, so app services itself, so app service, the first version that we launched was called Websites, and used to be seen as an entry level, but it's actually a very modern and advanced platform. It's really, customers are looking into app service now that you can do app web app hosting, so HTTP endpoints that have an HTML-based interface, or you can do more of the HTTP endpoints without interfaces, so we call these API apps typically. And then you also have services like mobile apps, which are features that enable you to program mobile backends in an easier way. So we have a number of features that make it really easy to add authentication, notifications, and stuff like that. And that is applicable to APIs or to websites in a sense as well, and to mobile apps. So app service, I think we have a lot of customers adopting it, and especially looking into app service and web apps as the first things that they're experimenting. And then it's really easy to get started. So we see a lot of adoption. And then when we are involved, it's basically when we go a bit further and we have more complex scenarios, or people are looking into more specific details on performance or how to optimize or how to do the whole DevOps flow in a way that is more streamlined. So the entry level is really low. But then when it comes to more complex projects or bigger projects, we really want to go from an end-to-end perspective, really managed. And then we are called upon as people in the field to help our customers in those specific countries that we cover directly.
Okay, I understand. And then there's this concept of an app service environment that exists. I've heard about. Can you give us some update on background on what that is and why might a customer want to use something like that?
Yes. So app service is a multi-tenant offering that we have. So this means that you will be sharing some of the infrastructure. You can host your applications on machines that you pay for, and you actually pay for each machine that you host your websites on. And these multi-tenant offerings, of course, they offer it's a large platform. There's a lot of advantages to leveraging the multi-tenant offering. But in some situations, you want some more kind of a single tenancy. I mean, there's several scenarios where you would want people or people start looking at app service environments. App service environment is really a single tenant setup or environment of what we offer in a multi-tenant setup. So it's very, very similar. It's almost a mini version of an app service environment, a full one, a multi-tenant one. So the main things that people look at is, first of all, network isolation. So if people want to isolate their own websites, web apps within a certain environment and have them connect to backend services, so VNet integration, if they want to have a web application firewall in front of it. So anything that has to do with network isolation is typically one of the reasons to start looking at app service environments. Other things are scaling. So by default, you can scale up to 20 instances. If you go into a premium level, 20 instances of your app services within a plan. If you need to really go much bigger, then app service environments also allows you to do that. On top of that, app service environments also allows you to control what's happening at the front-end layer. So when you use an app service, what's happening is we host, so in a multi-tenant environment, we host a set of services, servers that will take any incoming requests and map them and direct them to the right machines, your machines. Now, if you want to have a single tenant version that also does the front end offloading or SSL and load balancing, then you can have your app service environment do that. So complete isolation, let's say. And you can scale much broader, both on the front end layer and on the actual machines behind it. And then one last thing, I guess, is you can also go to a higher core machine. So you can go to 8 cores, 14 gigs of RAM, instead of 4 cores. So that those are the main reasons.
I see. Now, what's the downside for using ESC? Like, why would I not want to use it sounds like this is cool. Everybody should use ESC, right? I mean, what's the downside?
Right, it's just, absolutely. I think there's a few downsides, and the first of all is probably pricing. It is, well, let's say, compared to the app service, it's pretty expensive. The minimum setup is actually 6 cores, so you have at least 6 cores that are running at a given time, and so you're paying for those. The second thing is it takes much more time to provision the whole thing because it's a whole setup that we do just for you. So we have the services around it that have to control it, and we set up machines for the front ends and for the workers, and so it takes time. And now, so the two main reasons why not to look at it is really for any of the scaling operations, it takes more time. So to provision the initial one and to scale, and then pricing, because you have to pay those 6 cores. So pricing is a really important one, because for pricing on a multi-tenant setup, what you're paying for is really what you're using. So if you have a web app and it's hosted on a service plan that has 2 machines, then you're paying for those 2 machines whenever you're using them, and you pay for on a monthly basis. Now, if for one day you turn it off, one of the machines, you just scale it in or down, then you just pay the amount of time you have used it. Now, with an app service environment, it's not so easy for us to, in essence, it's not so easy to just scale, turn machines on and off. So you actually have to pre-provision them and then scale your web apps that are running behind the scenes. And so whenever you provision something, you have to pay for that, even if you're not running your websites on it. So in the multi-tenant environment, we have all of these machines already pre-provisioned, and we, Microsoft, are paying for them. Now, in a single-tenant environment, you actually pay for anything that you use, either if you host something on it or not. And so that's a big difference. And so that should be taken into consideration if you're looking at app service environments.
That's great. That's definitely a good reason why to think about it. But now, but if I were a shop looking at this app service in general, can I start with the non-ASV version, the multi-tenant version, and then later on migrate? Like, what's the sort of migration story to move into an ASV environment?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can start with an app service plan. maybe two concepts. When you're looking at web apps and web applications hosted on app service, you have a concept of something called app service plan, which is really your hosting environment, if you can call it that way. So you're actually provisioning, because they're already provisioned. Let me think of another word there. You're actually hiring those machines to be dedicated to you. And so they will be there, ready for you, and your web apps will be deployed on those machines that are part of the app service plan. And so you can set up your app service plans. You can deploy your web apps on it. You can have multiple web apps deployed on the same app service plan. So you share those machines only for you, those worker machines. That's an option. And then you test everything. But then at a certain point, you will find out you actually need network isolation, or you need much more bigger scale machines. Maybe take that example as an easy one. Let's say I need a P4, which is the biggest size. What you will have to do is, especially if you're automating, it's not such a big deal, because you will automate with Azure Resource Manager, for example. So you can have your application set up. What you will have to do when you migrate is the following. You will have to set up your app service environment, first of all. Once your app service environment is provisioned with the machines that you need to then move your websites to it, then you just have to recreate those same app service plan and web apps on the, actually what you're doing is you're creating them on another server environment, and you're just saying that they're hosted on a specific location. And so your app service environment becomes your location instead of West Europe or West US or East US. And other than that, everything else is basically the same. I think there's a few small differences. We don't support functions yet. I think that's probably the biggest difference today. And so from a migration standpoint, everything that you're used to using, I guess, except functions and some very small specific things, the web apps will continue working. Of course, you need to reset your DNS and some of those things that you would have set up. You would have to do that again. But you can automate a lot of that setup through Azure Resource Manager templates. So in essence, it could be really quick.
Yeah, to your point, Sujit, I've had a customer who's been using ASEs in their production environment and their pre-prod for doing sort of the final testing and deployment, but using the public app services for most of their dev test type work. And I think it's mainly around this time to provision and scale those web farms when you're setting them up. So putting those up and putting them down every night is not a quick thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's because you're actually creating or destroying a whole environment, and take into account it takes 2 hours today to provision a new app service environment. So you can do it, but this is something the team is working on to really improve. But today it takes, you have to take into account about 2 hours to provision an environment. So yeah, it's good to know that you have actual customers that in a dev environment would just use the multi-tenant version. If they no need the network separation or whatever they need for the production, then it makes complete sense, because all the rest is the same. You're still accessing app service plans. You're still accessing all the features, all the properties of web apps. So that should all work.
Yeah, that was a really comprehensive overview. Thanks for that. It was, you've taken most of my questions out of the picture because you've answered them that's really good. Thank you. One of the questions I had was around the improvements of speed, because that's one of the things that customers sort of mention most often when you're looking at ASEs. So we tend to end up having to separate the way in which we do the deployment. So we deploy the ASEs and provision them and have them up and running, you know, for a longer period of time, whereas in other places we might be provisioning the websites and then destroying them again, or using ARM templates to do the whole thing, whereas we'd split the ARM templates if you're doing an ASE first and then deploying to the ASE. I was just wondering if there were any plans around the improvement speed. I mean, you mentioned 2 hours. I think when I last looked at it a few months ago, it was a little more than that, so it sounds like there's some improvements already happening.
Well, I think two points there, indeed. So provisioning and reprovisioning every time, it's in essence, in a multi-tenant environment, all those provisionings provisioning elements have been done for you, so you don't really see it because we just initialize your app service plan and we just deploy applications into existing provisioned VMs. Now, in the multi-tenant, in the single-tenant environment, in the app service environment, or ASE, we call it actually, we still have this speed thing that the team is working on. Now, how much improvements they will be able to do and when, that's something I would not be able to comment on. That's something that the product team has to comment on. But I know they're working on it because it has been customer feedback, and we're really trying to get it to a level that would suit much more in a DevOps and automation world. Yes, we're really working on, the team is really working on getting that improved, because the provisioning is for once you have to provision the initial setup, which is a minimum of those 6 cores. And then you have a second thing that is provisioning, when you're scaling out your service, your pools of machines. So you scale out to add more. That today, will already be probably quicker than a few months back. The thing that I see most problems with around speed of provisioning or performance in the sense of provisioning is when people start doing, going from a certain P2 or P1 to a P3. And let's say a customer has 10 machines provisioned in a certain pool of machines. They're called worker pools. And once you go up, it's actually really bad because we have to move all those, we first have to provision them, and there's a whole complex system behind the scenes that really makes it look bad. In a sense, what we have these guidelines by which we suggest to customers, we recommend customers that actually not do any sizing changes, so you can scale in, scale out, no problem, and that should actually be pretty quick. I mean, it takes about half an hour for one of the machines, so if you have 10, it shouldn't take too long. But if you start doing scale operations in the up or down, then it starts, so you can only have one scale operation at a given time for an app service environment. So once you give that direction to scale, then just do scaling in and out, that's fine. Once you start scaling up, what we recommend is that you take another pool of machines and you move your service plan to that other pool that's already provisioned or that is already there. Then you start doing whatever you need to those other machines. Once you're finished, you just switch the service plan back to that pool.
Okay.
So there's some guidance there. It's not always very, very clear, probably. So this is where typically we find the most work and the most collaboration with our customers, is really to optimize that way of going first scaling either out or in, that's no problem. But once you start scaling between sizes of machines, it's really important to move your service plan, which hosts all of your web apps, to something that is not in the scale operation, and then do the scaling behind the scenes and then move back. And that really doesn't take any more than seconds it's just a restart of the application and you can warm it up. The customers never have to see any of that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, when you explain to the customer what's actually going on in the background when these things are happening, they become a lot more understanding of what's going on. It must be quite a complex set of operations going on there with all the networking and the VMs getting pulled up and down.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a whole managed environment, so yeah. We really want to take that burden away, and that does add some complexity, and sometimes it's not surfacing as the complexity is behind the scenes, and it's important to really explain what the best steps are to take there.
Oh, thank you.
Now, Katrine, you mentioned that one of the reasons for doing this ASE is to get network isolation. From that perspective, is there anything that customers need to be concerned about or to keep in mind, like when they're hooking up, I don't know, with the express route or something like that? Is there anything special that has to be done with an ASE environment?
Well, so an app service environment can be, is is actually deployed in a subnet, that can be either a classic network or, since July as well, we now have support for ARM-based V2 VNets. So you actually deploy your app service environment within a subnet that has to be dedicated. I think the most important things there are around the fact that you can have it deployed as an internal app service environment that is internal only. So it contains an internal load balancer, and it's not accessible externally at all. So it's used in corporate scenarios when you want to just keep everything, on premises. There's nothing very special about the Express Route setup itself. I think the most important is the way that you have to make sure that the app service environment, which is a managed platform, there are some ports that need to be open so that we can do the management behind the scenes. So it has to be able to talk to storage. It has to be able to talk to SQL database. So you cannot lock down everything. There are some small constraints in the way that you can do user-defined routing to mess up everything. But the most important thing, I think, is really reading the documentation around networking. It's really good documentation. And it explains how you have to keep some ports open. And you actually do that through something called NSGs, so the network security groups, at the level of the subnet. So for people in networking, the odd thing about it is keeping those ports open. But for the rest, it's pretty, I think, pretty normal.
That's good. That's good. Thank you very much. Any other tips that you can think of that you've come across? And Russell, I know you've done some work as well, so if you guys have any more suggestions for our listeners to keep in mind. Is ASE the one thing that besides what tips you might have, also I'd like to just ask the question is, you know, is ASE the first thing that customers should be looking at, or should they be focusing on their, you know, on a general app service and then think about ASE later? I mean, what's the guidance from that perspective as well?
Yeah, so I would recommend to look at app service multi-tenant offering first, because if you don't need it, the complexity that AAC adds is there, and there's the pricing as well. So I think looking at the multi-tenant version first, then if you start looking into VNet and you need more than just a hybrid option of connecting to a backend, there are some options in the multi-tenant environment, in the multi-tenant offering as well, but they're limited. So if you don't need that network isolation, then you can stay in the multi-tenant. It's around how much scale going up to that P4 size of machine. The network isolation is probably really one of the main factors, and then maybe also scale. You can actually scale up to 50 machines or even more within an environment. So if you really want dedicated front ends and dedicated machines where there's no other tenants, let's say, using the same front ends, then I think that's a good way. But always start with the multi-tenant environment and then look at AAC. And then regarding tips, not sure, Russell, if you want to comment, but I would really suggest, I would really recommend is to go through the documentation before you set up a whole environment, because it takes a few hours and it's not, I mean, there's some ARM templates. They're really good. You can find them in the IRM Quick Starts Templates Gallery. That's how I set up my environments as well after having tested a bit. But I think the subnet, the size of your subnet is important. You cannot change it later. The resource group, you cannot change it later. The location, you cannot change it later. You can just recreate everything, of course. But those are the most important ones.
Yeah, I mean, I'll echo that. Planning it in advance is the best way to go. I spent far too much time getting that wrong the first time, and then doing it again, and then doing it again afterwards. But you know, part of what I was doing was trying to make sure it was reproducible as well in different areas and different subscriptions. So yeah, it does take time. That's the only downside. But the customers I've come across that are using it, again, the main driver for them was the VNet integration. That was the sole reason they wanted to do it, really.
Yeah, primarily my case as well. Some for scale, but mostly VNet integration. Yeah, absolutely.
And if you have an MSDN style Azure subscription, you know, which has, I don't know, like $100, $150 US dollars a month credit, Is this something they could is worth trying out with an MSDN subscription? Can you do it? I haven't even tried it, actually.
That's a great question. So, unfortunately, it's so costly that you cannot run it a whole month. But you can do. You can test it out. I'm pretty sure you can. I haven't tried it because I've been trying it on an internal subscription. But no, you actually, it costs you about $1,200 a month for the minimum setup. So you can actually have it set up, have it run for a few days, and then make sure you just kill it. And so that's why I recommend IRM templates. You just set it up whenever you need it, test something, and then throw it away. But you cannot have it running a full month, unfortunately. It's too expensive.
Yeah, and particularly if you are using it for dev environments and test environments, make sure you put something like a monitoring alert on when people set them up so that you can see what's going on. Because this company where I said they were using it, and they were using ASEs in dev test before they moved to the public app services for those and just kept the ASEs in production. They had developers were able to go off and spin up their own ASEs. So before they knew it, there was sort of, you know, four or five different ASE environments out there, and they just weren't keeping track of it very closely. So, you know, obviously at the end of it, you're not thinking a bill that was quite
big. Really good tip. And it's very important to do the governance around it, because it does add up at the end of the month. It does add up.
So
a day or two is fine, but good feedback there.
Yeah, you can tie an email or something to the events when an ASE gets created or something like that, and have it email you when those things get provisioned, so you know what's going on.
Yeah, one thing is that something that can run? I know dev test is one of those things we have in Azure to kind of help control costs, especially when you're doing like dev stuff. Does that integrate in there at all, or is that not available in dev test yet?
It's not part of dev test labs, no.
Okay.
That's what you were referring to, I guess.
Yeah. I was just wondering, because then you could put that schedule around it to kill it.
Absolutely. That would be great. It's actually VMs for now, as far as I know.
Yep.
Great. All right, great. Thanks. This is excellent information. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Kitchen, and Russell for all your input as well. Anything else before we wind up the show?
No, I think this is great. Thanks for bringing all this info. This is I think our listeners will really appreciate it. It's a pretty good dive into ASE.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Yes, and Katrina, if you can, do you have a blog or Twitter handle or something that you normally use?
Yes, I do. I will send you. Yes.
Send it to me, and we'll put it in the show notes on the website so our listeners can get access to that. Right?
Great.
Great.
Thanks, Katrina.
Thank you, Katrina.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.